So here in lesson 11, chapter 10, verse 15, picking up where we left off last week, Solomon picks up by saying, "The rich man's wealth is his fortress. The ruin of the poor is their poverty." Now, I want to remind you of what I told you last week about how wealth and poverty is viewed in the Bible. We'll do it now, and then hopefully we will not have to hit it again later. A person who is a wealthy person in the Bible is a person who has enough to get by. Now, not a person who is poor in the Bible is a person who does not have enough to get by. A poor person does not have enough meal in the pot to feed the family. A wealthy person has enough meal in the pot to feed the family today. Tomorrow, there'll also be enough meal because provisions will be made. That person has enough. The example I also gave last week was a wealthy person will have two shirts, one for today to wear, one to wash for tomorrow. And then every day he washes the previous shirt for the next day and he wears the new clean one. A poor person only has one in the scripture. A poor person has one pair of shoes. A poor person has one cloak. He does not have overly enough. A wealthy person has enough all that he needs. Now, we don't think of wealthy being that way. We think of wealthy just being mega bucks and that type of stuff, being multimillionaires. That's not the way it is in Scripture. So here in the Scripture, Solomon is saying the rich man's wealth is his fortress. I mean, it's where he can find his safety, is in that he has what he needs. Many, many, many years ago when I was first married, my father-in-law was raising cattle, and he had difficulty with the equipment. The equipment would always break and need to be welded or whatever. So every time Kay and I went up towards Dallas to see her dad and her mom, I would throw in my stick welder, my MIG welder. I'd throw in all my tools, everything, so that I could fix water pipes or whatever had gone wrong. And we would be there outside. We would be welding stuff up. Well, one day we showed up early, and we were there, and we needed to go out and do some welding on a pin. They make these steel pins that they put a whole roll of hay in so the cows can reach their heads in there and eat. And before I went up there, there was a brochure about my father-in-law's company laying up on his counter. And I saw it, and it was a upcoming stockholders meeting for the year. And lo and behold, when I opened it, there it was in black and white, what he made, what his proposed salary was going to be for the stockholders, plus options and that type of stuff. And I thought, oh my, that's a whole lot of money. And when I laid it down right next to it was his pen and his glasses. And here was his monthly budget. And because he always lived on a monthly budget, he did not just spend just to spend. And so there was his food, how much he spent on food, and meticulous. He's a list person. So he had written down what he had spent the first week on food and spent the second week. But he had a budget number out to the side, and he would recopy this every single month. My wife does the same thing. She's a list person. You know, and then you get to the next day and she recopies the entire list fresh, new. I'm not that type. I like to see stuff scratched off. You know, I've accomplished something. She likes to make a new list, and her dad did too. Well, we got out, we started welding, we were talking. I do not remember how the conversation came up, but I started saying to him, "Dad, you know, you make a whole lot of money to live on such little money. So think about it like this. Think about it. This is how much money he made. Well, he lived on this much money." You know, because he came, born in 1930, in his years early, and he and his brothers the same way. And, and I said, "Dad," I said, "you know, you really don't spend much money compared to what you make." And his quote to me was this. He said, "Son," it's your first two lines in your lesson here, "rich people are rich because rich people do what rich people do, no matter how much money they make in a lifetime. And poor people are poor because poor people do what poor people do, no matter how much money they make in a lifetime." that really did not mean anything to me until I became your Helping Hands minister. And lo and behold, the first person that came in that could not pay their bills and was looking for help from me back in 1993, help paying their bills, and they made three times what I made. Of course, I'm debt-free, and I live in a much nicer house than they do. I don't drive nicer cars than they do, but they were, you know, because I drive cars until the wheels fall off of them, and then I go buy a new car, so I get my money's worth out of them. But I don't have near what they have, but everything I have is paid for, and boy, they have everything. They've got the house here they've got the mortgage on. They've got the house up at Lake Livingston they've got the mortgage on. And this was 24 years ago, now 22 years ago now, so I can tell the story. They've got three cars that they have notes on. They've got the boat that they have the note on. They've got the dock fee that they have out there. They've got two kids in college. They've got, I mean, just all the money is just spent, and they can't pay their bills. And so I'm going through my little thing where I'm saying, okay, listen, you have to have pocket money to spend every day, or you're going to start fighting between the spouses. And that's probably, that was the problem. The reason why they'd come in is because the wife didn't have any money to spend on makeup and spend on a Coke or whatever, because the husband was so tight with the money, but the husband didn't have the money to give her because he was trying to pay all these notes. And I remember backing up and pushing the paperwork to them. I said, okay, I'm going to tell you what. I am going to help you in a tremendous way right now with your budget. I can help you within the next 7 days fix your budget so you can afford to let your wife have some money to spend. Well, actually, the problem was that she was spending money anyway, even though they didn't have the money to spend. You know what it was, because she wasn't controlling the purse. And he was controlling the purse, and she was going to spend some money. I pushed the paperwork. I said, here's what I need for you to do. I need for you to sell what you owe on and buy what you can afford. No, they left the church. No, that didn't go over well. They got so mad at me, they left the church. But at that point, I didn't know any better. And then it became a reality to me that there are many people are out, as the years went on, there are people out there who make a whole lot of money every year, but they have borrowed so much money that, and it's cost, they're paying back. My dad used to say it only, my dad was a debt-free person too, and he would say, you know, just because you have enough money to buy the product right now, if that product is not the best product on the money, wait until you have enough money to buy the best product. Always, when you're buying furniture or you're buying anything, buy the best. It, and he would say it only costs a dollar more to buy it, buy the best, and buy it one time in your life. And that's a true statement. My wife and I have some stuff that we bought, we saved. We were tempted to buy not the best, just buy something to make do until we could make enough money. And we saved. And those items are still with us today, now after 36 years of marriage. The stuff that we just bought to make do, you know where it is? Over there in the landfill, you know, the Greenbelt landfill is where it's ended up because it did not hold up. When you owe, you can't catch up, folks. You just cannot. And if the thing to do is to trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding, but in all his ways, acknowledge him, and he will direct your path. And your God will supply all your needs according to his riches and glory, not your wants, but your needs. And every time you go out and you make this note, on the golf cart, on the, you know, the, it's just everything out there. You need to go ahead and sell and downsize and then rebuy one at a time as you have the money. Rich people save a majority of what they make and live on just a little bit. And in fact, it has been my experience that some of the poorest people that I know that just are having a struggle of a time every time I talk to them actually make more money than some of the wealthiest people in the church who don't really make that much, but they've just been good stewards of what God has given them. Well, in this case, Solomon is correct as he tells Rehoboam that the rich man's wealth is his fortress. The person who has enough for the day and enough to get into tomorrow, that is security. But the person who does not even have enough for today, that is his poverty. And it leads to poverty. You know, we had another one of our young couples. I'm not sure how many babies this makes that they have. I think it's baby 8 or baby 9. And by the way, it's all been girls. They've not had any boys yet. And I keep thinking, do they know what it costs to raise a child? Where's the money coming from? And you know what? They are so faithful in everything they do, and they don't make a lot of money, but they have enough. They have enough. And besides that, that little old baby just upped their wealth by more than you could ever imagine. Because kids really do increase the wealth of you as a parent, as a grandparent. They are priceless. There is nothing out there that you can gather and pay for what that child brings to a family. And you're saying, well, I got a grandchild that you ought to see. He didn't bring it. Yeah, he does. Yeah, he does. Or she does. Brings a lot of knowledge and understanding about life and about the Lord. As in fact, it's some of those little wild grandkids that have caused you to be in a relationship with God more and more as you've been on your knees beside your bed praying and crying out to God for a grandkid. Yeah, they're there for a purpose, and you know what? Those prayers will not return void. They will not. The wages, verse 16, of the righteous is life. The income of the wicked is punishment. You know, righteousness leads to spiritual life. Wickedness leads to spiritual death. Any way you look at it, wickedness leads to spiritual punishment. The payment for what a righteous person does is his life. A life here and life everlasting and life eternal. The payment for a wicked person is eternity away from God here, a time of life here away from God, and also eternity away from God. And so we have to understand that as we want to be a righteous person in everything we do. Verse 17 says, he is on the path of life who heeds instruction, but he who forsakes reproof goes astray. Path of life. You realize that we're all on the path of life, and the path is still going because we're all here right now, and we haven't arrived yet. We arrive at our final destination once we cross over from this life into eternity. The problem is we're all on the path, whether we're wicked or whether we're righteous. We're all on the path headed. But when the crossing over happens, some of us go one direction and some go the other direction. But the person who is righteous on this path of life will seek instruction. Will heed instruction. They will be looking on how they can find something new to learn every day about the Lord, how they can store up the things that they have learned, how they hunger and they thirst for things about the Lord. Interesting side note on that is that a few weeks ago, I had spent almost all day studying, getting ready for one of these sets of lessons that I'm teaching you, and I just felt like in that one day's time, pieces just started falling together. Things and thoughts and verses and passages just started falling together. You know how it is, how, you know, you struggle for years, and then all of a sudden, it just all just goes together. And so there it was, and I thought, and I praised the Lord, and I said, Lord, thank you so much that today I think that you have taught me more today than I have ever known in my life about you all put together. I mean, it was just one of those grand days, just a beautiful day with the Lord. Just, oh, the understanding that just came of why things are happening the way they are, more than I ever thought. And after I got through praying, I was decided to, Kay asked me to go down to the grocery store, and I'm wheeling through the grocery store, and I thought, you know, I prayed to God thanking him for how much he taught me today, that I've learned more today than I've ever known in my life. But it's kind of funny because 41 years ago, when I was a brand new Christian, 18 years old, I thought I knew everything. You couldn't have told me anything. Whatever you told me, I was going to argue with you about it. You know, if you told me that my theology was off, I would have not listened to you at all. Today, if you tell me my theology's off, I'm going to listen to you. I'm going to let you talk until you have either convinced me that my theology is off or you have convinced yourself that your theology is off. Because you know how that is. You can have one thing in your brain and you think you're right, but then you start talking about it, you actually talk yourself out of it to where you realize you were wrong. But I'm going to listen. A righteous person, and I'm begging you too, as a righteous person, don't be argumentative. If someone comes up to give you an instruction about something, listen, take heed, go search it out, figure it out. See if that person is right. See if there's any truth in it. But I tell you what, the fool is the person who forsakes reproof. Reproof is not a bad word. I know it would be a bad word today if we used it like we use it today. I'm going to rebuke you or reproof you. Both the word rebuke and the word reproof just means to say something to somebody that is something that is opposite of what they have thought. But it's not to do it in a harsh manner. And so here, Solomon is saying to Rehoboam, as you're going through this life, heed the new things. Hunger and thirst after instruction. And when somebody comes up and says something to you that you don't agree with, take it, because there may be some truth in it. Verse 18 says, "He who conceals hatred has lying lips, and he who has spread slander is a fool." Now, it just so happens, these things always happen on page turns. Did you know that? It's just like those of us who are musicians. The hardest passage, the hardest two or three measures in any piece of music always happens on a page turn. It's just the way it is. You know, why couldn't they have just adjusted the page so that was in the middle of the page? But it's all, you know, and had it been in the middle page, it would have been still the hardest passage. The same thing happens. Here it is. Happens on a page turn. I wish it didn't. It didn't when I had it blown apart for editing, but when I pulled it back together to small spacing, it came apart. It's got the word "and." It doesn't have the word "but." It's got the word "and" in the passage. So that I have learned in studying Proverbs means there may be a problem with the English translation. So that takes me, because it doesn't fit the pattern of all the rest of them, it takes me to go back and look at some of the English translations of some of the other texts. The original Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament that the Jews used, was called the Tanakh. That's the Bible, the Hebrew Bible, that Jesus used. But in 250 B.C., 250 years before the birth of Christ, the Jews, because so many of them spoke Greek, the Jewish leadership oversaw the translation of the Hebrew Tanakh into Greek. So when Jesus comes along, he doesn't only quote from the Hebrew Tanakh, he also quotes from the Septuagint. Both of them are the Old Testament that we have. The Hebrew is the original. The Greek is the first translation into Greek. And we know in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, there are places where Jesus is quoting to the people either from the Hebrew or from the Greek. And that verifies the Greek. Well, in that Septuagint, the Greek, it translates this verse a little different. And look, let me remind you of what it did say. He who conceals hatred has lying lips, and he who spreads slander is a fool. The Septuagint reads like this: righteous lips cover enmity, but they that utter railings are most foolish. Well, that just added a new perspective to it. And then we go to the Hebrew Tanakh. Dissembling lips keep hatred secret, but he that speaketh any slander is a fool. Which one's correct? Well, we kind of have to pull them all together. Dissembling means to play act. That's what it means. You're just play acting. You're just acting, you know, playing around. So therefore, the Septuagint and the Tanakh both pose for us two new problems. Well, with one using the word righteous and the other using the word dissembling. So we've got a problem here. Nevertheless, the two remove the idea of lying lips. They don't talk about lying lips, so I don't think that our English translation should talk about lying lips. And whether one is righteous, we can understand, or whether one is play-acting, as in the other one, what we can grab from this is the wise person will keep secret his hatred until the proper time to reveal it. But the fool will immediately let out his hatred. Now, it's not godly to hate something. It is not godly. It is very godly to be angry and sin not. And I think basically what Solomon is talking about when we say hatred is not the word hatred, it's the word anger. That there's an anger towards something that's been said. When you come about some person that you're interacting with and you have anger towards them, the wise person will hold his tongue. The fool will turn right around and spout it back at the person they're angry with. And you know how that works. And you know how much that helps. Anger, spit back at anger, only ends up in anger. This is A plus A equals A. Is that how that works? That's bad. I'll take that away. I don't work on that, you know. A plus B equals C. That's how they usually say it. Well, this is just the same thing. One times one equals what? Okay, that's how that ought to work. All right. Anger and anger equals anger. That's all you're going to get. So a wise person will hold their tongue. And at the proper time, in the proper place, when their anger has subsided, the message that needs to be delivered can be delivered and delivered easily. Verse 19 says, where there were many words, transgression is unavoidable. But he who retains his lips is wise. Transgressions. Unavoidable. Where there's a person who is a talker. A talker. People do not like to be around talkers. 35 years ago, I had a pianist that was a talker. Oh, she was a great pianist. Ooh, yeah. Anything I started singing, she knew exactly what key I was in, and she could play along, and she was marvelous. All up and down that piano, just like that. I mean, she could just play every key and get at it. It was incredible, but she talked exactly the same way. She would call me on the phone, Brother Jim. Hi, Dottie Mae. Oh, yes, ma'am. Uh-huh. And I'd go get me a cup of coffee. And I would go work on some papers. And I would stack books. I'd come back. Uh-huh. Yes, ma'am. Mm-mm. And I would go stack papers. And I would sweep the floor, whatever I needed to do. Oh, yeah, Miss Dottie. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Miss Dottie, I really got to go. I've got some important things I need to do. Can we catch up another day and take care of business and hear the rest of the story? Okay, goodbye. And 45 minutes. And she never knew I wasn't listening to her. She's a talker. The stories were always, always the same. That's the problem. Because she had a burden on her heart she couldn't get off her heart. Because she had a daughter who back in the day went to Woodstock. Do any of y'all know what Woodstock was? It's kind of interesting. In my 8 o'clock class, I had a couple of rows of college kids sitting there, and they had never heard of Woodstock. And I just told him, I said, you know, it was just something that happened back in the Dark Ages. And back in the classical period of life. And they know no different. And the daughter was just the most wonderful daughter. Just got in with the wrong group and went to Woodstock and all that. And lo and behold, 4.5 weeks after coming back, the daughter died. And the problem was, she was always telling me and always telling me this. And then as the story would go on, every once in a while, there was this little drop or hint of bad, because mom was always making it good. Always making it good. And then the little bit of bad came in. A little transgression that the daughter had done came in. And then, lo and behold, a little more. And so finally, after 4 years, I sat down with Dottie. I said, Dottie, was your daughter really a good daughter? Oh, no. We had had trouble with her since she could walk. You know, she was always the wild one. I said, but you always try to picture her. She said, that's just the way I want to remember her. I said, but Dottie, you talk so much about it that people don't want to hear it anymore. People don't want to hear you talk. No one comes to talk to you at the piano because you'll hold them there for 3 hours talking to them in the story. Everybody goes out opposite doors. They look to see which way you're going. You need to get on with life. Your daughter has been gone a long time. Your daughter caused you much grief. But your daughter did many transgressions and many sins. But you have another daughter that's younger, that's a wonderful daughter. She's a florist. She's doing wonderful work. Why don't you start talking about the daughter that we all know, the daughter that is here, instead of focusing on the daughter that is gone? That's just one example of talkers that try to talk you into. She had talked about it so much, she had talked herself into thinking that the daughter was a righteous daughter. But the daughter wasn't, and she knew it. Another example is of this, and all of us have lived long enough. In fact, some of you have relatives that are like this. You have relatives that they're addicts. They're into drugs, illegal drugs. But boy, they can snow you. They can sell you anything. They could bring you a box of black dirt and tell you it was the best soap in the world for your clothes, and you would buy it. And therefore, those type of people are the ones who are able to talk their way around to get all the drugs and everything that they need. You know what I'm talking about. You've seen people like this. And what happens is those people get into this whirlwind of a spin in life to where they get it so to a point where there's no turning back. And they can't get off of the drugs. They can't get off of the things, of the sins that are happening in their lives. But boy, they're talkers. They are talkers. They can just tell, they come in, they tell you everything from the reason why. It's everybody else's fault that something is happening in their life. But the person who is responsible for where they are right now is themselves.